Smirk.
Big brr. Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your remote Utah compound of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I got my own, if I don't need security in the club. All they wolfing on the net, I thought you was a thug. And I ain't got nowhere to go, I shot up everywhere they would. Yeah, you know who took this from you, come get it back.
We took a week off, unannounced. Sometimes you come for the sabbatical, sometimes the sabbatical comes for you. That's how it works. We're here with a mailbag episode. The home team is in the building. Karen Gans is here.
Hello.
Taking a break from crucial occasional chair research to bless us with some opinions today. Thank you, Karen.
I am indeed shopping for a new chair, and it is taking over my life.
We have been trading links. A lot of chairs look alike is my main takeaway from that.
A lot of chairs that I select look alike.
I wasn't going to drag you, but yes, that's accurate. Joe Coscarelli is here.
I'm sitting on a metal folding chair, as I have been for the last two-ish years, though I was gifted like a little Instagram ad, like a rubber thing to help my posture.
You mean like a cafeteria type chair? Like something that like
the thing you hit someone with in WWE?
I was going to say, yes. Karen would know this type of chair from her nightly viewing.
Wow.
Wait, that's a chair that you own? Like that's your preferred chair?
It's just the chair at my desk. I'm not a picky guy.
Hey, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
That's gangster, man.
Joe is going to be broken.
Joe, you wrote your book on that chair?
A metal folding chair, yes.
Basically. Seriously? Should I get a metal folding chair?
I mean, it's not good. It's not good. I don't recommend it. But I tried. I did what you guys have been doing. I tried to buy myself an expensive office chair for working from home. And I just hate shopping so much that I got too frustrated and never followed through.
Okay, this is actually relevant because Joe has just completed his book, which will be out next year. I am sort of on book leave right now, although clearly hosting an episode and many other episodes of podcasts, doing a bad job of it. I have an Aeron chair that's a little wobbly, but it's after warranty, so it's a pain in the ass to fix. I was actually thinking of getting a gamer chair. I thought maybe that would be like, who sits in chairs longer than gamers, right?
Did you see the Ben Simmons house?
And I did not see the Ben Simmons house.
Ben Simmons of the NBA, although not currently.
Right. He's up moping on the sideline, like as the rest of the team has a good time. Right. Kind of energy.
Listen to John talk about sports. He he recently listed his home in New Jersey because he plays in Philadelphia. So, of course, he lives in New Jersey. And there's a intense gamer room with many chairs that you should take a look at. Oh,
okay. I will get on that. I was actually... The one I was looking at, and hell, if people have any opinions on this, I'm all ears.
I know. This is going to be the most popular part of this podcast.
Yeah. So the Secret Lab Titan Evo, which seems to be a very popular gamer chair, and I ID'd it when I was watching Axios the other night. And on Axios, they were interviewing some like Bitcoin guy down in the Bahamas. And this is the chair he was vibing in front of like 12 computer screens. And I was like, if this guy... is this relaxed in front of all these computer screens? Maybe that's a chair I should look into. Anyway, if people have thoughts, I'm into that. Also, I'm looking for a research assistant.
Hell. Oh, wow. All right.
While we're here.
Listen, first assignment, my chair, which for the record, okay. Not a desk chair. This is a living room accent chair. There's I just want to be clear.
There's a lot of interactivity on so
Karen,
far.
You're talking about couches. I thought you were talking about desk chairs.
That's not a couch, Joe.
You know what I mean. You're talking about, yeah, living room.
Yes.
You say chair, all I can think of is the desk that I sit in every day in the corner of my bedroom.
Joe has been writing his book in a Brooklyn public elementary school third grade classroom, apparently. Anyway, if anybody wants to help me with research, I'm needing a research assistant. email me, jcbookresearch@gmail.com. I made a whole new email address.
Oh my God.
Wow.
I did. You think y'all think I've been on book leave not doing anything. I made a whole Gmail account. So just drink that up. Okay. jcbookresearch@gmail.com. Would love to hear from folks who have some time. Obviously, it's a paid opportunity. Anyway, we're doing mailbag and we put out the call on Twitter. We put out the call in the Facebook group. For the first time, we put out the call in the Discord. I joined the Discord. What I learned from joining the Discord, and shout out Kat, who is modding that Discord. Some people have way more time during the day than I do, and it's wild. Shouts to y'all for filling that up. Very, very impressive. Joe, have you gotten in the Discord yet?
I've not gotten in the Discord, but I've recently been messing around in some other music Discord. So
what? You were cheating with other music Discords?
Well, they're going to go unmentioned in this official forum, but they're a little black markety. But I will. I'm going to take a look.
Those good Discords.
Yes.
Rare Discords.
Invite only.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Dark corners of the internet. Well, then this is for a guy who is diving into rare Discords. This opening question may be an invitation to be dragged, and potentially for me to be dragged, and potentially for Karen to be dragged, which is why I picked it as the first question, because it is equal opportunity for us to all fumble. Okay?
Let's go.
Wonderful.
This question comes from Sean. And again, in advance, if I, speaking of fumbling, if I fumble the pronunciation of your name, please accept my apologies. First question is from Sean Prislack. Sean wants to know, when was the last time any of you bought a physical album and what was it? Any format?
Wow, I love this.
I know. I read this and I immediately, oh my God, my sweat, the brow just got moist, extremely moist.
I'm really happy I have a good answer.
Oh, well, okay, then you can go first.
Okay, so when I was last in Louisiana and Mississippi reporting on Britney Spears, I ended up at a gas station and they sold bootleg mixtapes.
Nice.
Old school style in, you know, skinny jewel cases with covers printed from like dot matrix printers, basically.
Or photocopies of a cover printed on a dot
exactly,
matrix printer.
Exactly. I have them literally on my desk next to me. I bought a fake mixtape called Fed Baby by NBA Youngboy.
Nice.
I bought Fujiano's Gutta Baby.
Phenomenal.
I have a Lil Baby, Da Baby, Baby Fever DVD mixtape, which is 70 tracks long.
Phenomenal.
A Lil Baby one called Everybody, which is also 70 tracks long. And Pooh Shiesty's Shiesty Season, 64 tracks on a DVD.
Wait, so what's on the 64 track DVD that's not on the Pooh Shiesty album?
Look, that's gonna take your research assistant to figure out.
What's the going rate in the Louisiana gas station CD DVD marketplace? What's the going rate?
I mean, I just like bought a pile of them in addition to like some t-shirts and stuff that the gas station had and send wrap snacks. And, you know, I did a lot. So I think I probably dropped like $50 total.
Fair. Okay. That's a very good answer. I support it. Karen, what do you got?
I do have an answer.
Well, I'm actually stunned we all actually have answers.
Yeah.
So yeah, go for it.
I generally don't want physical things to enter my life anymore. You know, I live in Manhattan. It's not a palace. You know,
oh, like, just casual flex. You live in Manhattan. Okay.
New York City, I could be more vague. There isn't a ton of storage. I'm reorging, as you can tell by the chair. So I don't usually buy physical music. At the end of every year, when I make my top 10 list, I then go and I pay for all that music in case I have not over the course of the year. So I do buy music every year to support the albums I love. But in, I think it was not July, it was June. It was over the summer. I was in Vermont and I went to two LP shops there. Shout out Ben Cesario and the Vinyl Revolution story. I bought like a stack of singles, mostly Madonna singles, things of that nature, old pop stuff, nothing new, nothing from this century. But I spent like $130 at both stores.
Wow.
Yeah. Damn. They were happy to see me.
I bet.
Yeah.
Good answer. Okay. Here's my answer. I don't actually know if this was early 2021 or late 2020. There is a very hole in the wall used record and CD store near me. Not super near me, but like a long walk from my house. and it's very dusty. I don't know if it's open anymore. It's very dusty. It's the lighting's terrible. Piles and piles and piles of completely disaggregated stuff of all genres, all styles, and all formats. But every now and again, when I would go in there, you could tell that they had just bought out, you know, whether it's like a record store or some DJ's collection, because there'd be a cluster of a particular kind of thing. So many years ago, I bought a bunch of like very arbitrary rap promo CD singles from like the mid 90s, one of which I later sold on Discogs for like $90. But this
are you allowed to say this stuff?
Absolutely. It was not sent to me.
He's blame flipping.
Blame the person who dropped it off at that store.
Probably like someone that we work with or know.
I definitely was like scouring those labels to be like, where's the name on them? Because I definitely know this person. But in the most recent trip, they had very clearly either bought out or gotten a dump of Spanish language CDs, Mexican, Colombian, et cetera, et cetera. And the covers, they're mostly mixes. They don't look super official. The covers are incredible. So I've got a stack of 8 CDs from them. They were probably about $2 to $3 each. I'm looking at Madrazos Sonideros 2001. I'm looking at Escuadron M19 Colombiano, Tu Sabes Que Aja is the name of the album. It's a very vibey cover, big vest energy on this album cover. Al Calor de la Cumbia, Duende Mix 2. And this is music of Peru, Argentina, and Mexico. La Banda Mix from DJ Aztec. Some of these I've listened to, some of these I've yet to listen to. It is largely mayhemish, dance adjacent, or club adjacent.
Cool. Great buy.
Truly, I would have bought the entire crate. There were probably 200 to 300 CDs. And I just, you know, at a certain point, I was just picking based off covers because I didn't recognize any of the names.
I look forward to you spending a little bit of your book leave making a SoundCloud mix out of that, the best of this stuff.
Yes. That's every time I take a break from sitting at my desk, I'm going to walk back to that store and just see and like slowly leech them one or two CDs at a time.
And then make us a blend.
Yes, absolutely. Sean, there's your answer. I hope that was satisfactory. I hope we pass the vibe check. Moving on, Halsey.
Woo.
Yeah. So Halsey put out a record this year. We have not talked about it on podcast. We have two questions about the Halsey record. Shivani Goel and Amanda Privet Beam, both essentially asking what we think. And Amanda said, I feel like on one episode last year, the consensus was Halsey's close to making a great album. Was this it? Also, Halsey is using they, them pronouns, if people are not aware. I have an opinion about this, but I'm fairly certain the only opinion that's allowed to be broadcast on Popcast is Karen Gans. Karen Gans, Halsey's album, If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. That's dark. That's very dark. That's a dark album title. What's the vibe?
It's the album of the year, John.
What?
it's my number one. It is, really.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
You could have guessed that. You could have guessed it. Think of, if we just break it down into its component parts.
Right? Album of... Okay, yeah. So justify each of those four words for me.
I mean, I'm not going to ask you for your list now because it's too early and I know you haven't started doing it yet.
ESTG plus 9.
I was gonna say ESTG and Halsey fighting for hardest album of the year.
Real spit. Okay, Karen, bring it down. Because I actually do have thoughts on the Halsey record. I listened to it knowing that I was going to have to face this question.
Okay, well, I have a couple of points, but I'm going to make them briefly, and then we can all chat as a group. But if we were just purely
very gracious.
Thank you. Listen, I'm just trying to conduct this orchestra, guys. Just work with me here. If we are to break this down to its component parts, what could be more Ganscore than the sound of this register voice?
Mm-hmm.
Recalling back to the female-fronted pop punk that I enjoyed of the Ashley Simpson, Avril Lavigne variety from the, you know, earlier part of this century.
Oh, yeah.
Blended with a darker, often guitar-centric, sometimes synth-centric, brooding, thudding, fascinating sonic component. And on top of that, this is a spectacularly sequenced album. And you know, that's something that I'm very focused on, but I couldn't believe how well it was sequenced the first time through. And I've tried to sort of pick up in the middle. I have a couple of favorite songs and it doesn't even work. I have to go back to the beginning every single time. Wow. I honestly think this might be their masterpiece.
Wow, that's a very labor-intensive way to listen to albums. Okay.
I like it so much. That is how much I like it.
This is Honey from Halsey. So, Karen, this may come as a little bit of a surprise to you, but I am not in total disagreement with you.
Oh, that's pleasant.
Never heard those words before.
you know how he usually says it to me is, actually, that's not a bad idea, is what John says when I come up with an idea that's good. I want the world to know how this editing writing relationship works.
Oh, my gosh. Actually, this Halsey record is very good. I will say this, it does not feel to me of a piece with earlier Halsey records, and maybe Halsey's like chameleonic approach album to album is the most fascinating part of their career. I was very, very struck with the production on this record. I hadn't really thought about the sequencing in those literal terms, Karen, but I think that's probably right. Like, it does feel very, very cohesive in a flow sense.
I mean, we should probably mention who produced it.
You're dancing around an important point.
It's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, correct?
Yes.
Trent Reznor, as you may know, from Nine Inch Nails. Atticus Ross from movie soundtracks.
And also a member of Nine Inch Nails.
So what they have brought Halsey, if I have any hesitation about the record, there is... the context of the record feels a little weightier than Halsey feels on the record. I think Halsey's well suited to it, but it does feel a little more deterministic than maybe the vocals stand up to.
I don't agree. I mean, Joe, I'll let you talk, but I think that Halsey stands up to it.
There's obviously an easy narrative, right? That like what Halsey needed to make a great album was like some old guys from the 90s. And like maybe, but I do think Halsey has been leading up to this. I think like they were able to potentially, you know, realize this vision that Halsey has had from the beginning of their career. And I think every album is a story. Every album is really thematically heavy. There's always like these interludes. There's always these characters. Mm-hmm. Like this has been the selling point. It just, you stack up Trent Reznor versus Lito or whoever that guy was that Halsey was dating and collaborating with early in their career. And like, it's just, you know, it's not a fair fight. That said, I'm a Manic guy. I think Manic is the best Halsey album. It's the best Halsey music, I think, since the original Room 93 EP, which I was very into. I wrote a story about the beginning of Halsey's career. But I think, yeah, I think this is just like perfect time, perfect place. You know, Halsey was pregnant. Halsey had a child. It just all lined up, I think, here, even though this isn't really the music I want to hear from my pop singers.
Can I quote John Pareles briefly, who reviewed the album?
Of course.
Disappointed that he didn't make it a critic's pick, but we didn't talk about that at the time. Because I didn't, to be honest, I didn't have the time to spend with it right when it came out. So I didn't even realize how great it was. But both Halsey and Nine Inch Nails have made it their mission to pack the bleaker impulses of human nature into pop song structures. Noisy, desolate, sometimes assaultive tracks that still resolve into neat verses, choruses, and hooks. Yes. Just so,
yeah.
Extraordinarily well said by JP. I mean, I think that these elements have been in Halsey's music the entire time, and that this is like just a very neat crystallization. And I don't even get necessarily parenthood vibes from the album. I just get this sort of like overwhelming bleakness, but there's also exuberation. Like Honey appears to be a sort of lesbian celebration. I'm just saying. And there's some very upbeat rocking songs that aren't quite as bleak, but I'll be curious to see what the next album's content is about. But if this album was being made and thought about during a time of extreme personal change, you know, in terms of parenthood, it's not reading that way directly. And that's appealing to me.
Let me ask this though. is this the sonic palette that makes sense for Halsey moving forward? Because I do think, more so than any pop star, and I do want to put that in maybe light quotations, because I don't think that the breakthrough has been total still, but do you think of any pop star of like the last 10 or 15 years? I can't think of one who has shifted more era to era, moment to moment. Does this feel like a landing place, or does this feel like a statement of purpose that then you carry with you into whatever the next thing is?
I wouldn't want to hear an identical replica of this record come next. I would want to hear elements of this into something else. But I think you're right. I mean, when you think about pop stars shifting their sound from album to album, I think Halsey's been more successful than Gaga. I'm just saying if you're gonna swing, you know, from aesthetic to aesthetic, I think that Halsey's swings have served their music much better.
I haven't watched the film, have you guys?
No, not yet.
I have not.
It looks high budget, but I don't know about all these music companion films in general.
That's actually a great segue to another question we had. This is coming from Sarah White. What is the future for music videos? Will they be short films like Lemonade and Starcrossed, or will they just fade into oblivion like MTV's heyday? Joe, do you want to build on that? The kind of like ambitious, potentially overambitious long form companions?
I mean, look, I'm pretty sure I've answered this question on a previous podcast. I just like south of the Beyonce self-titled videos and Lemonade, like, I just don't have that much use for these visual albums. It's not how I consume music. It often just seems like blowing a budget in the way of like late 90s videos, but less good and less economical timing wise. Look, like the best music videos are regional rap videos on YouTube. Like there's just no, and those are made for no money. It just can't help but feel like feeding the streaming content maw. And I just like, I'm just not interested. And I'm open for stuff to change my mind, but like, you know, Casey Musgraves, I don't want
Well, let me speak on the Musgraves one. I think the legacy, unfortunately, of Beyonce self-titled and Lemonade is that for younger artists who come up after that, there's this perception that to be taken seriously, to feel like you've reached the A level, whatever that might mean, that you're entitled to some kind of big vanity film project like this, or that your album cycle is not complete without some kind of complimentary overwrought film. And I think Starcrossed was unfortunately an example of that. The aesthetic I thought was interesting, very vivid, very beautifully shot. I think a lot of money was spent on it. I don't think a lot of time was spent on it, certainly not from a narrative or writing perspective. I think there is this perception that you have your fans' attention and you want to hold it. And the way you hold it is by giving your fans all this extra stuff. But to me, the Starcrossed film does the opposite. It doesn't deepen the narrative of the album. Quite the opposite. I think it fragments the narrative of the album and makes it more confusing. And so I think in general, these like big films don't do the thing that I think artists hope that they will do. That said, I do have an answer to this question. That's not this. You know, look, what is a music video, right? Is it the lyric video? Is it the visualizer? Is it a narrative? Is it live? Is it a full song? Is it full songs with narrative pieces? Is it a 15-second snippet that goes on TikTok? There are so many different ways to approach video content, especially in a mobile TikTok era, that I think this kind of central idea that a song has a music video, that's going to go away. I think there might be 10 music videos for every song, but I don't think the music video is going to be as essential 5, 10, 15 years from now as it is now.
I don't know if I agree with that. Don't forget that YouTube is still the number one streaming service.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, if you want something that works well on YouTube, maybe that's a classic music video, or maybe it's some 7 to 9 minute thing that's lightly narrative or live performance or some intersection of those things.
Yeah, or 7 to 9 seconds. You're speaking a bit abstractly in critic talk. I'm interested in it from like a financial perspective and from a fan perspective. Like, you talk about a lot of money being spent on something like the Casey thing. I'm curious whether artists are doing this and blowing a bunch of money on it, you know, blowing a bunch of their budget. Or on the other hand, if they're doing it because the streaming services, the Amazon Primes, the Disney Pluses, et cetera, are paying them and they're actually making money from it. I mean, like two words for you guys, Guava Island.
Wow.
Wow. I never thought I'd hear those two words together again.
So I gotta be honest, that is the second time I thought about Donald Glover today. And that's two more times that I've thought about Donald Glover in years.
But interesting, the thing you brought up on YouTube, John, just wanted to make one point. I didn't get this into the story, but when I was writing about NBA Youngboy and the marketing that he and his team do, especially while he was in prison when this last album came out, the label did something for the fans that I'd never seen before on YouTube, which I thought was very interesting, to say the least. Before the album came out, they put out a lyric video for every song on the album, but it's not the song. It's the beat and the lyrics on the screen, but you don't hear it. It's just like a little sneak preview to like get the fans excited. So you can literally hear the song, but you have to imagine how he's rapping it.
Is it like a karaoke production kind of, or it's the actual
beat? Yeah, no, it's the actual beat. It's like very low budget. It's the instrumental, and then the lyrics are on the screen, but you don't hear his voice, which I'd never seen before. So I do think like people will continue innovating in that way. That's not a music video per se, but it is music and it is on a video streaming platform. Yeah, it requires a video. Yeah.
Is that your way of saying, let's listen to Toxic Punk by NBA Youngboy?
Let's go.
Wait, I had one last point on this. I'm not sure if we can blame Beyonce or whoever gets the origin point for this sort of high concept long form video.
I mean, Michael Jackson.
Sure. Of the most recent era. But is that where we trace the hoity-toityification of the term visual? Because if I get one more press release that says visual instead of video, it's the end. It's not a visual. It's a video.
Yeah, we're on the verge of filtering out certain emails, publicists, just FYI.
There's no such thing as a visual. It doesn't make sense. All right, I'm sorry. Go on. We can listen to Youngboy.
What if I do so? Stone, said she love me. Ugly boy, toxic punk, they don't love me. Yeah, foreign hallucinations, all I see. Acting crazy, get the police called on me. Flat,
baby stone, said she. Here's a question from Shad D'Souza. Shad has been on Popcast. Hello, Shad. Also, thank you. Shad did an interview recently with Music Journalism Insider via Todd Burns newsletter. And Shad said that he listens to back episodes of Popcast and Red Scare every morning. So I can't imagine what kind of sickness that has rendered you with, but thank you.
Better than coffee.
Yes. And I hope you are well, is really what I have to say. Shad had a couple questions, but here's one that struck me and I feel like I have a lot to say about. It feels like Nicki Minaj is on the outs with the mainstream superstar rappers, where she used to feature on a lot of big projects. She now mostly sticks to songs with up and comers, Sada Baby, Bia, Tekashi, NBA Youngboy. Or big pop stars doing watery cash grab collabs with people like Carol G, Megan Trainor, Jesse Nelson, etc. Do you think her absence from recent superstar rap records is her choice or theirs?
Wow. That's a good question.
I'm pulling on my collar.
Oh, wow. I don't know if it is her choice. Okay, so this is speculative. Here's the speculative. I'm not privy to any inside knowledge. This is speculative, right? But I do think in the post-Cardi era, when many people leapt to work with a fascinating new talent, to say nothing of post-Megan, I think that there were lines drawn in the sand at that point. And I'm sure there was a lot of behind the scenes agitations about who's rocking with the new person, as if there's only room for one female rapper. I mean, this is something we have talked about on podcasts multiple times. There obviously should be ample room for multiple artists. But I do think that this era that you're referring to, Shad, feels a little bit like it started with Bodak Yellow. And I think Nicki is someone who a lot of younger rappers grew up on. And it's still kind of a coup to have Nicki on your record. And certainly on a pop level, there's still some value to it. But it felt to me that there was some implicit camp line drawing a few years ago. And that has remained the same.
I think more broadly, like, Nicki's career is just in a strange place, right? We haven't heard music from her in a minute. Her standing in especially the rap world, but also the pop world is, you know, I think it's an open question at this point. And I'll just say the last two Drake albums, he opted to have Nicki talking on the albums, not rapping. So wow. Make of that what you will.
So let's listen to Crocodile Teeth. I believe it's a remix. This is with Skillbang. It's a reggae record. You know, Nicki goes in that bag sometimes and thinks she's really good at it. So this is something that I've heard a bunch lately, and I think she comes off really well.
And also, John and Joe, I don't know if you're aware that Nicki made an appearance on The Real Housewives of Potomac reunion.
Wow. I missed that.
Sure, yeah. Well, it hasn't aired
yet.
You just missed it. The news that it's happening, where there were sure to be fireworks and, you know, arguably her hottest appearance of the year. Just saying.
I like the Bia track. I think it's pretty good.
Okay, so the consensus is Nicki is having a moment. Anyway, here's Crocodile Teeth. Wow, we dodged that one.
Hey, yo. First thing I'ma do when I pop out is tell my nigga, yo, make sure you got the Glock out. I just hopped out looking like a knockout. Show these bitches how to do it, but they dropped out. Yup, bling, bling, if the watch out. Tell them watch out, I put the block out. Talk shit, but when they see me, it's a cop out. They don't get the big picture, they get cropped out.
You and I are here, listening to this episode, for the same reason. We like, or in my case, love, listening to great stories. I had this moment with my friend Christian a few years ago. We were talking about this amazing article we had both read, and it occurred to us. There's all this fantastic journalism written for the page, but what if we could listen to it? I'm Ryan Wegner, and that friend and I, we created Autumn, which curates the very best stories from the world's most respected publications, so you can hear them read aloud by world-class narrators. From the New York Times to the Atlantic, Rolling Stone to Mother Jones, Autumn is how you can experience stories in a whole new way. Download the Autumn app or go to autumn.com. Subscribe and start listening today. That's AUDM.com.
Here's a quick one. I assume for me and also I know for Joe, this is from Nicholas Howe Bukowski, who wants to know, is the Kid G album sad or angsty enough? Joe had one of my favorite bars of the year when he referred to Kid G as UGA Youngboy.
So I made that playlist as a joke, right? Which was just alternating the Youngboy album and the Kid G album. But I'm telling you, it works.
I totally believe. Oh, wait, you weren't calling him UGA Youngboy?
No, I was. Oh. I was calling him UGA Youngboy, and then I made a playlist called The Young Boys, which were the two albums that came out on the same day, alternating tracks.
Got it. Okay, guys, yes. UGA Youngboy is a great, if he has not embraced that, he should embrace that. I think the Kid G record is good and possibly very good.
I agree.
I don't know. Is it angsty? Here's the thing with the Kid G record is there is still, I believe, a struggle. I assume this is on a label level, you know, and a kind of like institutional level. Do they try to work him in a more conventional country way, which obviously like in recent years maybe tilts lightly towards hip hop notionally? Do they try to work him in that conventional format? And I think there are several songs on this record that if they were on the Parker McCollum record or whatever, people would be like, whatever, fine, it's a normal country song. But because it's on the Kid G record and because he's got the ATV stuck in the mud on the cover, you know, it's for some reason it feels different. So those songs, I would agree, maybe are not as angsty as I would like them to be for someone who grew up idolizing Juice WRLD. But I would encourage everybody, and frankly, in this moment, I'm going to force everybody to listen to Paper Heart's F-150.
Yeah, come on.
Because if this doesn't tear you apart on the inside, if this doesn't make you weep, if this doesn't take you back to Midwest emo in the 90s, like, you know what I mean? Like, what are you doing out here? Anyway, Kid G, Paper Heart's F-150, get a Kleenex.
Chrome hearts on the car heart, yeah, yeah. Push it twice and the car starts, yeah, yeah. Up play shooting dark stars, yeah, yeah. You get the point like a dartboard, yeah, yeah. Ooh, bad with a little twang. I'm the kid, I'ma let it hang. Six string, I'ma let it bang. Wrist wet and it ain't rain. When I skirt down the back row, can't help but slide.
What a sad boy podcast this has become.
I see, my thing about Kid G, I think that something this album does well is like the party songs are pretty good You know, like I don't necessarily need angst from him. Like I think 2000, I don't know, is like a keeper. You know, like I'm fine with some of the lighter stuff.
And there's a version, again, there's a version of his arc that ends up more in that direction. I think that's okay, but I don't know if that's going to be the direction that justifies the A+ headline, meet country's next emo rap star.
My question is like, is...
Come on, I started out 2021 with a banger.
That was,
come on,
let's just true.
Acknowledge that I started out this year with a banger.
My question is Kid G happening? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I haven't been to the tour. I'm eager to see what his crowds are like.
Wait, did that come to New York already? Do we miss the New York tour?
I don't think it happened yet.
Okay.
But we'll go. I just need more Kid G fans in the world because I think this album is really good.
Yeah, I don't think it's happening, but I think the reason it's not happening is, again, because of that tension. And country being the most cloistered, the most parochial of genres when it comes to mainstream radio-friendly acceptance. I mean, you can imagine the radio programmers being like, Kid G, I'm not going to play Kid G. Like, I've got like 7 more Luke Combs songs to get through. Like, the idea that I even make room for a Kid G song. Like, this is why country radio is awful when it comes to structural issues. Anyway, something we'll return to, I'm confident. Here's a question from Zayal Lee. And the question is, after seeing Maggie Rogers make her Discord, which I'm not up on. Is this one of the secret Discords you're in, Jeff? Maggie Rogers Discord?
I'm not up on the Maggie Rogers Discord.
Also, Maggie Rogers seems to be a graduate student. Is she at Harvard? Is that a thing?
I heard that she was back at school. I don't know the details, though.
I watched a TikTok where she was like racing back in a van with her bandmates to make like a 10 a.m. class.
Call your alumni network, John.
Yeah. Okay. You know, excuse you.
Look, I'm not going to let you guys have an Ivy League pissing match on the podcast. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Is Brown in the Ivy? I did not know. I just Googled Harvard, Maggie Rogers, and the autofill was Harvard. And here's the Boston Globe article. Singer-songwriter Maggie Rogers is now a Harvard grad student. She's at the Divinity School. Shout out the Div School. I had a lot of fun taking Div School classes when I was undergrad.
Walking in the footsteps of Gans Court legend Rivers Cuomo.
I was just going to say that.
But this question is not about Maggie Rogers and the Divinity School. Here's a question. What do you think will be the next platform / way for artists to engage with their fans? It seems like more artists are making their own Discord and having direct push notification to their fan base. I would assume this makes a lot of sense. I am still a Discord newbie, so I'm not fluent with all the functions and with how it can be weaponized in the attention economy, but this does seem to make a lot of sense. Joe, what's your vibe?
I want to take it all the way back. I want mail in fan groups, fan clubs. I want longhand letters between artists and fans. You know,
I'd be thrilled.
No more apps.
That's true. I'd be so thrilled. Like, going to the mailbox every day is such a drag. It's just like, oh, another bill, another issue of Billboard. First of all, sidebar, the Grammy issue of Billboard has Halsey and Trent and Atticus on the cover. And I thought that was a little bit of a reach, low key. Anyway,
We'll see what happens.
I've got to assume, is there a Taylor fan club where she like literally just like handwrites you notes? Like, there's got to be.
I think
that's
just like, if
that's just Taylor.
Yeah, that's just being a Taylor Swift.
That's just being a Taylor Swift. Yes. I agree. I would like to see a resurgence of micro intimacy. Discord feels like a macro intimacy. I think that micro intimacy should make a comeback. And I think it could make a comeback hand in hand with Ben Cesaria's recent piece alluded to this. I did a piece about independent hip hop vinyl getting pushed towards, you know, $70, $80, $90, $100. If you're quite honestly identifying your most dedicated fans and mailing something direct to their house, why not add something personal on top of that?
Yeah. But as far as new actual tech platforms, I don't know. Maybe I'm getting old. I don't want to know, frankly.
Speaking of tech platforms, here is a question about one tech platform asked on another one. This is from the Discord. This is the first question from the Discord.
We're going to NFT this.
Yeah. The username is Mikostan. Or Mikostan. And here's a question. Given that all you need is a solid meme to revive your career slash song slash appreciation for your work. See Fleetwood Mac Dreams, for example. Will there be a cottage industry dedicated to making old shit go fake viral for aging artists who need the coins?
I think already is one.
And would that be unethical?
Welcome to the music business.
Yes. Like, I've got a
press release this week that said Led Zeppelin's catalog is now on TikTok.
Barf.
No, and I mean, look at the stuff that's been going viral on TikTok. You have like a Rod Stewart song, you have No Children by the Mountain Goats, like all, you know, like, yes. Basically, everything that's done on a grassroots level will get professionalized by the industry late and worse. So take from that what you will.
Correct. Sidebar to that question, this is a question from Kelly M. It's a question for me, but it's really for Karen to answer. The question is, John, would you ever use TikTok as a medium for your critical work? Karen, am I allowed to issue critical opinions on TikTok?
That is a good question for management.
You are management.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, I would say, if I was answering that right now, I would say as an accompaniment or a side dish or a collaboration with your work on the New York Times platform.
Wow. Nice. Good answer. Wow. When I wrote the piece about Anthony Fantano, you know, and it was a little early, but I think ultimately is playing out, the angle was that he has sort of become the blueprint for a new generation of critics, and most of them are on TikTok. You know, the people I pointed out at the time, you know, were just the beginning of it, but I think that has bloomed in the months since.
I will say we are going to do not to tip our hand, but we are going to do a year-end episode with the music critics of TikTok. So
nice. Let's go.
Coming soon. It's that time of the podcast, of the mailbag episode. It's that time. And you know what time that is. It's Taylor time.
Are you allergic to awesomeness?
People know that the people who make podcast have very strong opinions about Taylor and have been thinking about Taylor for a very long time. Even if Taylor did not put out a record for 6 years, we would still get Taylor questions for mailbag.
Mostly Taylor questions.
Yes. Yeah. So we have, perhaps unsurprisingly, several Taylor questions. I think we should just take them in a run. What do you guys think?
Yeah, let's do a lightning round.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. First one is for me. It's from Melody Karama. The question is, have Folklore / Evermore grown on you yet? The answer is no.
Have you listened to them?
Once or twice.
Okay.
Can I answer that too?
Sure.
My playlist is so spectacular because of the sequencing and song selection that I do listen to it all the time. And those songs that I have chosen, I think, are spectacular. And I think I did underrate them at the time that the albums came out. So I'm willing to admit that.
Wow. You're really just going to leave me out here.
I'm just telling the truth.
On Nevermore Island. You're going to leave me out here, huh? Okay. Yep.
All right. We're a Folkmore family.
Yep.
Yikes. Joe, is it growing on you? Stick with you? Same level?
Yeah, I think I'm more and more confident that Folklore is going to be remembered as an apex Taylor record. I think there are albums with higher highs, but I think it's the best front-to-back Taylor album.
Wow.
Unreal. It's like I don't know you.
I wish it weren't the case. Like, we're all going to have to do that thing when the Red reissue or re-record comes out, where, like, we pretend that Red is the best Taylor album because the first 7 or 8 songs are perfect, but side B has got some stinkers.
Just because other publications feel compelled to do that does not mean that we will. The next question is from Shivani Goel again. What do you think of the Fearless re-release? Did the production changes Taylor made fall in line with what you expected? I do not think of the Taylor Fearless re-release. That's my answer to that question. I know I'm sounding really curmudgeonly about these Taylor questions, but I very much do not think about these things as anything other than craven attempts to crank up business and streams.
I think it's a bit unfortunate how long this has gotten dragged out. I mean, it could only take this long because it's a huge undertaking, but like I think it just lost the juice that it might have had in the beginning, and it's purely for the fans.
But I will say this, and this is something that I'm sure people at record labels are taking note of. What Taylor has done is essentially demonstrated, and obviously she's a rare use case value. She's super famous with startlingly dedicated fans. the power of catalog and lightly reframing a catalog product and turning it into a Billboard number one record. I am sure the question before is like, are there people at record labels trying to get TikToks popping on old artists? Absolutely. Are there also people at record labels looking at albums and being like, how can we take this 14-year-old record and make it seem new and take it to number one? Those people are working overtime too. I think it's hard to replicate what Taylor's done. And certainly like the business and psychosocial circumstances that have led to it are hard to duplicate. But it has demonstrated that newness as a concept is really not what we thought it was. It's a different thing. And all you have to do is activate people who are interested, and they can be activated around any kind of product, be it an album of new originals or an album of self-cover songs.
We've all heard that Elton John Dua Lipa song, right?
Have we?
We have.
Next Taylor question is from Caleb Stark, longtime bestie Caleb here. Hey, bestie.
I told Caleb that John was going to pick his question. He was like, I submitted a question. I said, John picks the questions, but I bet he'll pick it. And here we are. I got a little tipped off to the subject matter.
My cue is about the Olivia Rodrigo / Taylor Swift after the release crediting. Mm. Do you think it's Taylor Swift and her team making demands to provide songwriting credits after the fact? Do you think this kind of behavior could inadvertently start a larger conversation about the melodies and lyrics that Taylor has, quote unquote, borrowed over the years, on purpose or otherwise? And then one of my fave borrowing moments that I never want to shut up about is her swiping lyrics and melody from Hilary Duff's 2015 song Breathe In, Breathe Out on two separate occasions on two albums. I think we have talked about this on podcast.
Yeah, because of Caleb, I'm sure.
Yes. So let's actually listen to a little bit of Hilary Duff's 2015 Breathe In, Breathe Out. It might seem like a stretch to some, but it seems more similar than Deja Vu does to Cruel Summer. Actually true. So I guess the ultimate question is, should Hilary Duff's songwriters get credits on Taylor's album now?
Wow.
This question was a journey.
Yeah.
I would like to say the answer to that by the metrics of 2021 is yes. If you are a songwriter on that Hilary Duff song, I would imagine that you could have a very interesting back channel conversation.
You're crazy.
I would also imagine that you don't have enough money in the world to go up against Taylor.
This does not constitute legal advice.
No, but it's a two-part answer, right? Because I happen to think that the way that the Olivia Rodrigo stuff has been going down,
and also with Paramore, with Hayley Williams, we should note.
Well, and I think that case is a more credible case, broadly speaking.
I don't know how credible any of this is. I don't know. We're speculating about this.
Let me get to the end. The end of the point is all of this is poppycock and it should not happen. It absolutely should not happen. You should be able to nod at, wink at, even lightly embrace and give a noogie to a pre-existing song within your framework, and short of an outright melodic ripoff that forms the basis of your song, I think that should be, in essence, handshake approved, like as a de facto rule.
Yeah, like that's how I feel. In rap music, exactly, where people rap entire verses that are references to other people's songs and verses. It's what makes the genre amazing.
It's homage. This is songwriting accretive history built by one songwriter on top of another with explicit acknowledgement. The actual inclusion of the line or the riff or whatever, that's the acknowledgement. That's the handshake.
Yeah. And as soon as you get lawyers and corporations involved, obviously it's worse. It's worse for music. It's worse for creativity.
Do I think that Taylor's team is making the demands? I certainly don't think Olivia Rodrigo's team sent an email and said, hey, we've got a couple million for you. I don't think that happened. There was, I think, a Billboard article speculating on how much money was transferred out of the Olivia Rodrigo and I assume Dan Nigro songwriting coffers into others, and it was 2 or 3 or maybe 4 million. I don't think that was initiated by Rodrigo's team. But I do think if you are going to take the position that you are entitled to this piece of this younger artist's song, you should be ready if somebody comes along and says, actually, we are entitled to a piece of your song.
But we all know how power works, so you know, sure, we'll see what happens.
I understand, but the point is, to my reading of strict 2021 application, I think if you're, you know, if you got your hand out, you have to be watching your own pocket. That's how I feel. But in my heart, none of this should happen. It's all trash. I hate all of it. I think it's bad.
I agree with you, John.
It's bad for creativity. It's bad for music. Mm-hmm. It's bad for the collegiality. And I understand this is a business, but it's bad for the fundamental collegiality. And Joe, I think what you were alluding to before, these ripoffs, quote unquote, or borrowings or acknowledgements or however you want to frame them, aren't even that foundational or fundamental. Like shouting in a Taylor Swift-y way, that's a modal choice. That's not a copyright choice.
Yeah, but no one wants to go to trial. You know, Ben Cesare has written about this extensively. You know, the Blurred Lines case is huge, looming as a precedent. And we're just going to keep seeing this stuff. And they're interesting stories to follow from a music business perspective, but they're a little depressing from a fan of music and art perspective.
Absolutely. Okay, last Taylor question. This is also from Shad. And this is a little bit of a deeper question that I know everybody on this call will have thoughts about. Shad says, I, like you, am a reputation apologist. Mm. I mean, it's not the first thing on my resume, but it's up there. Partly because I can't help but listen to it as a Kaler concept record. Mentions about, quote, secret moments in a crowded room, dancing with our hands tied, no pronouns on Gorgeous, references to a doomed love, I loved you in secret, etc., etc.
Oh, wow. Back to Kaler.
I was going to say.
Very general question, but do you have general thoughts, feelings, opinions on Kaler and Kaler truthers?
Wow.
We should lead off right away with that. We do not know. Anything we say from this point forward is not actionable. We do not want to hear from any about this. I also want to shout out, I have a social media mutual, Christina Drill, who is also super into this. And we have talked about this a bit over the years. So this has been on my mind.
I was just saying,
should we just play the audio, the messy bitch lives for the drama audio and just like keep it pushing?
Karen, go in. I hear you're winding up.
What I was going to say is that like, I really never indulged in that conspiracy theory. And when you initially read the question and said Reputation is like some sort of concept album, I'm like, yes, about as Taylor as a pop star interacting with contemporary pop, which is pretty much how you read the album in your review, John.
Yes.
And I believe there's legal
reasons. right.
No, but legitimately it does seem when you step back from it and you look at it now, it does seem like a giant album length thought experiment about like how can Taylor inject herself into the current pop conversation. And then she uninjected herself almost as soon as it was over. You know, there's remnants of it on Lover, but you know,
you're dodging the question.
I swear to you that I've never read anything about this. And you would think it interests me. The day that we thought that the news was real, I almost lost my mind.
I'm broadly pro the queering of popular culture. There's a great history of fans projecting these narratives onto work. I think that if you're an artist and you're putting work into the world, you want people to be engaging with it in that way.
To be thinking about it.
Yeah. And, you know, creating these story, alternate storylines, alternate interpretations. I think it's great. Obviously, it comes so much from Tumblr, which again is sort of like Taylor's home base of a social network. Like, I think even if it may seem sort of personally invasive, it's like a great mode of fan-based criticism.
Right. It's slash fiction.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah. And also the thing you have to remember, there are far more literal artists than Taylor whose work in any medium have invited alternate readings. I mean, look, it's been since sophomore year of college since I've read Umberto Eco and Roland Barthes and all that stuff.
I'm having flashbacks to papers I wrote about this phenomenon.
Yes.
Right. But like the intention of the text is not the same thing as the intention of the author. Like there are ways to read texts that do not have to agree with how the author presented them. It also, the author can leave things purposefully open-ended to encourage a myriad of readings. We all know this. I think the answer to the question is the things you are drawing attention to are partly purposeful, but they may not be purposeful for the specific purpose that you are alluding to.
I will say I have a long-standing, infrequently used group text that is jokingly, not jokingly, I didn't name it, I don't think, called Kaler Forever. So, you know, it's in my life as a theory.
Totally fair.
To follow your extremely highbrow analysis, I'll just offer one extremely lowbrow analysis, which is you need to calm down, and it's extremely seemingly queer video is one of the least queer things I've ever experienced in my life as a gay person. So I have sincere doubts about this theory.
Okay, moving on from Taylor Swift, but with a question that mentions Taylor Swift. And this is actually, I did think about this one quite a bit, but I didn't come up with an answer. This is from Ben Barzilai. Ben says, you've talked about your ideal career trajectory for Taylor Swift, the Joni Mitchell album, etc. Drake's Certified Lover Boy felt uninspired to me, and I think he needs the Caramonica treatment. Where would you like to see Drake go from here artistically? Is it time he finally makes his case as R&B's reigning prince? Man, I don't have a clean answer to this. I agree with you about CLB. I said as much in my piece. That said, anytime I've listened to songs from CLB kind of in passing over the last couple months, they just sound like pretty good Drake songs, like a lot of other earlier Drake songs sound like pretty good Drake songs. I do feel like the bloat era is true, though. We, you know, the last, say, 4 years of Drake. My answer is maybe a little different than the R&B thing, because I don't think Drake would be fruitful as a straight ahead R&B singer. And certainly, like, not in the era of, like, Brent Faiyaz and, you know, if Bryson Tiller ever pulled it all back together, Bryson Tiller, you know, I don't want Drake doing whatever that is. But Drake as a someone who becomes a go-to globalized collaborator, like who is making more efforts to work with African artists, who is making more efforts to work maybe in East Asia, working within K-pop, certainly Latin America, Spanish language artists. I'd be really interested in a version of Drake that's less preoccupied with, hey, we made all these structural changes to what we think of as the center of hip-hop, and I got to stick with that. That's where I live now. I would much rather him build on the thing that is already happening, and which I've written about and we've talked about a bunch, which is the Drakeification of popular music globally. Why not very simply just go out and live in those spaces much more than holding down the same turf? But I'd love to hear if either of y'all have an interesting take on this.
All right. Here's my thing. Drake has done so much so well for so long that any version of Drake that you want, basically from any period of time you want to put those parameters on, you can make that, you can build your own Drake. It's, you know, like the global Drake album exists, you know, throw 12 of the best Drake songs. The R&B Drake album exists. The pop Drake album exists. The drill, you know, you want to hear him rapping over weird drill beats. I think people need to free their mind from the tyranny of the album. I'm exasperated because I'm just like, I don't know. Like, I just don't know what else people possibly want from him. If you like Drake, there are so many good and different Drake songs. I just don't know that, like, he needs to make a pivot. Obviously, he's going to have to grow up at some point. Like, I'd like to
hear. That's the question. But to me, that's more the question. Like, it's not that I think Drake needs to have a different style. He's not Halsey. You know, he doesn't need to have a different style, but the idea that Drake should be doing, hell, let him do full length collaboration albums with Bad Bunny or El Alfa or Raul Alejandro or you know, who knows, you know, like that to me is potentially way more interesting to see him sharpen steel against people who have learned and studied implicitly at his feet for the last 10 years. That would be fascinating to me. Like, for example, here's a record Drake did with WizKid. It's called Come Closer.
To mix up in drama, to free my mind. Jealous people around me, I need to change my life. I just turned colder,
every time I try.
If you think back to like the late 90s or the early 2000s, and you'd be like, huh, like Puff is on this strange record. It's European record, or Will Smith is collaborating with some person I've never heard of, who's like the most famous, who knows what, you know, like Italian singer or something. I'd be interested to see a version of Drake testing in those spaces. And I agree. It's not that these versions of this don't exist anymore, but I do think that it is starting to feel like a tiny bit like we're in a rut over the last couple of years. And so the question is, how do you get out of the rut without asking the person to completely reorient and reinvent a style? I mean, look, would I love to hear just like a Drake, like underground Memphis tape where he's just like, all he's doing is like Memphis flows? Sure. Do I want to see Drake like rapping with like Shawnee Bin Laden? Like, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This is a question of packaging, I think. Like, you know, and the obvious answer is like 444, right? Is like 10 Drake songs over Alchemist beats. You know what I mean? Like, or whichever guy he chooses, and all about one thing. Like, obviously he's gonna do that. Like, Jay is the blueprint, you know, like that, I think that will happen. But I think that the rut is more, it's like numbness. It's not about the quality of the music. It's about the frequency and sound of it. I don't think the 20 best Drake songs from the last 4 years are worse than the 20 best Drake songs from the prior 4 years.
Okay, I don't know that I actually agree with that, but I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I will say the 20 best songs of the last 4 years, and this is actually would be an interesting exercise if we did this, the 20 best Drake songs of the last 4 years would be more scattershot than the 20 best Drake songs of the previous time period.
I don't know if that's true.
No, but to me, the previous time period is coalescing around a sound, nailing it, inflating it to huge pop heights. The last 4 years have been a kind of leaning into that sound on some level, and also like kind of a lot of strays in other directions that I think are some of his better songs are the strays. And so I wonder if the last 4 year Drake exercise would be tonally consistent.
Maybe we'll make some playlists.
Okay.
This
I'm into that.
Fun. Yeah.
This actually, okay. I'm into it. Okay. Let's do that. And let's revisit it on a later episode.
Yeah. We should refine the time period. 4 years was sort of arbitrary, but yes. Yeah, we'll refine okay. the time period.
Okay. So we are going to do this, and then I will put out a call on the Facebook group and the Discord, and like y'all can get involved as well. So I feel like on every mailbag question, we have one question where I'm just like, do you just want to come and take the job? Like, do you just want to, the question is so thorough and we're just like, okay, cool. Like, that's an article. Like, just do that. So this reminded me, this question, of the demotic vocal question.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that was a good one.
A legendary one.
An iconic question yeah. from previous mailbag episode. This is from, and it's sort of similar. It's side by side with that question. This is from Campbell Chupik. I've been thinking a lot this year about female pop star stylized vocal trends. In the past 5-10 years, we've had more female pop stars that I see using really specific stylized vocals. The biggest stars do this in a way that feels recognizable, but put off as natural, Lord, Billy. You also have people like Halsey, who got decently made fun of for their vocal style early on. Now I feel like we're at a place where aspiring pop stars are imitating these trends, and the result runs the gamut from awkward imitation to pure cringe. Olivia's Deja Vu is good, but the verses sound like she's doing Lord drag rather than singing in her own voice.
Wow.
I really started thinking about this when I heard what up-and-coming pop singer Tate McRae was doing. What are your thoughts? What function do these vocal trends serve in the arc of pop history? When do you think they're effective and when do they detract? Has every era had trends that felt like this, thinking of early 2000s Britney voice or something specific to this moment?
Great question.
Yeah, really good question.
Could do a whole podcast about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here's my thought. And the reason I said this is kind of side by side with like the demotic vocal question is I do think the way that pop stars get built today, which is to say internet upwards rather than industry downwards, and big generalization, but generally speaking, I think that's fair, is I think you learn a lot about what people's tolerances are, what their ears can tolerate. I think that there was a sense, certainly in the 90s and 2000s, that the ear could tolerate only like a very specific kind of vocal approach. Even Britney's thing, which is like a little bit croaky,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have a lot of range. you know, it's not overwhelming. Obviously, Christina Aguilera, sort of a very, very powerful talent in that same time with much bigger range. I think what you learn is that if things function from the bottom up, there are a lot of people who have a wide oral tolerance for these kinds of idiosyncratic vocal styles. And maybe there's a lot of like sad girls and boys and others on the internet who gravitate towards that. So I think there's more room for it now than there was 20 years ago. That's my gut.
I do think it's a little bit timeless, though. Like, and the question asker nodded towards that. But, you know, like, people learn by singing other people's songs. Like, you can literally see Olivia Rodrigo covering Cruel Summer on YouTube, you know? So, like, you know, you get to see where she learned to sing from and where she learned to write from. And I think it's, like, fun to spot that stuff. Take it back again to, like, a Drake thing. Like, you can see Drake's influences and you can hear them over time and you can tell what he's listening to based on the time period. I think that goes beyond sort of like pop girl stuff. But I think you're right. And the Lorde long tail is quite long. I think we're still hearing a lot of Lordes, but I'm hearing a lot of Billies in my inbox, you know, a lot of,
I agree.
You know, I think of someone like Gracie Abrams, you know, who, you know, every time I check in with her new singles, I'm like, okay, like maybe you're working towards your own voice. And I mean that in all senses of the word, but like, you're not quite there yet. You still sound like a pastiche. I think that's normal and fine. And a function of this moment in pop history is that we get to see a lot of that development that may have previously happened in the background.
Okay, we're going to do two more questions, but quick shout outs just before we do those last two questions. One, Lawrence Purrier emailed in. I had talked about Tramps on a previous episode, the old New York Hip Hop Club. He sent in a scan of an Ultramagnetic MC's ticket from a Tramp show in 97. Thank you, Lawrence, for being old. So I appreciate that. Also, Tom Bryan emailed in. He wants to know, and maybe y'all have a good answer for this. I certainly don't. And it makes me want to do an episode about it with Tom. What is our favorite hardcore record of the past few years? Wow. And I feel like I don't have a good answer to that. And I want to have a good answer. So if y'all don't have a good answer, me and Tom will do an episode at the, like in the beginning of the year.
Have but you done a Turnstile episode?
I haven't, but I feel like that's the cheap answer.
Yeah. You know? I don't listen to enough modern hardcore to have an answer.
I listen to some, but I feel like not in a comprehensive way. And so that's good homework for me.
Do you like that Armed album, either of you guys? I've dabbled and I think it's good.
I think it's good.
I have not dabbled, but I do like the Turnstile record.
Okay, Tom, send me an email. We'll do an episode. Okay, so the last two questions. First one's from David Cohen. This has been lightly touched upon in podcasts, but never fully broken down. You've spoken about how many current pop stars have been pulling their sounds away from heavier, more hip-hop EDM-leaning influences and going with generally lighter, airier, softer-sounding production on their latest albums. Billy, Lorde, Taylor come to mind. What do you make of this move being influenced by great tragedy? In this case, the pandemic. I feel like this sort of mirrors the post-9/11 soft pop rock explosion of the early aughts, with artists like Jason Mraz, Gavin DeGraw, Jack Johnson, and Norah Jones gaining huge amounts of popularity, culminating with Norah Jones's many Grammy wins in 2003. Are these things connected? Does pop music generally respond to great international tragedy by becoming less abrasive and confrontational? Great question.
Good music criticism.
Very, very good question. What do y'all think? First of all, do you see something pandemic-y, either production-wise or singing-wise, in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months?
I mean, I don't know if it's so much the pandemic as like the Jack Antonoffification of music. You know, you just sort of look at who the in-demand producers are and what their general modes are. And I think a lot of the music that the questioner mentioned was in the Jack mode.
I think the thing missing from the question, and it's sort of a pivot, but as he mentioned, we've talked about on podcasts before, the thing missing is race, right? Like these are white artists who dabbled in black sounds when it was maybe more possible to do so without anybody calling you on it. I think, like, you know, you've seen a cultural shift. And I think, you know, the industry also is a pendulum, right? And every time things, you know, are more maybe black, you know, then you see this response of whiteness. And that's, you know, has to do with what gets played on the radio. That has to do with, you know, what corporations are backing. There's a musician, Jamie Brooks, who is great on Twitter, a great music critic on Twitter. And Jamie talks about this a lot. And it's like, you can sort of see for instance, the EDM boom was perhaps a reaction to a corporate reaction to rap getting so popular. So, you know, I think with the sort of boom times of especially like street rap now, regional stuff, you know, stuff that never would have been reaching the audiences that it is at the moment, you get a little knee-jerk response to that, even if it's not explicitly running away from that stuff. I think culturally that happens.
I will say that I do think the thing that people seek out in popular music is not always the same. And I think there is always going to be a quest for safety. And pop is a safe harbor for a lot of people. You know, just even seeing these names, Jason Mraz, Jack Johnson, like, the, you know, artists that I have this kind of like deep-seated revulsion for. You know, the Jack Johnson show at the Garden, when I used to review concerts primarily, when that was my job, genuinely was one of the least happy nights of the 2000s for me. I mean, it was like, it was unbearable and people were loving it. It was such a spectacular room to be in and be the absolute only person on the verge of tears. Not good to you. Like, it was awful. It was risible. It was terrible. But I do think that people crave the softness. And I think coming after 9/11, that's interesting. I don't know that I've thought about it in those terms, but I think that could be very real. I don't think that the pandemic has functioned exactly the same, because with the speed that media moves right now, people don't linger on a feeling very long. There is no national mood. There are multiple national moods. And so I don't know if it would function the same way either in or post pandemic. But that's interesting, and someone should write about that early 2000s stuff through that framework. I'd be really curious to hear that. Last question, and guys, you have to forgive me. This is a question specifically for me that that you, I believe, cannot have an opinion on because it is about me. We are going
that's
to-
That's what you think.
That's what I think. Surprise.
So this is, let's just get into it, because this is something that came up on the Facebook group. It wasn't in the thread about the listener mailbag, but it did come up in the same time frame. So I feel like I have to address this. This is from Andrew Robert, who says, "Yo, John, whatever happened when you came to write about the Pickathon Festival and ended up ... incapacitated ?
Wow.
I can answer this, but yeah. Well, okay.
may have been for the best, because you know we were coming for that long ago promised hug for print subscribers, but honestly was looking forward to that New York Times take on an Oregon festival, and it was right there, and then ... Also, in one of the other comments in that thread, you said that you were a local music writer and you were coming for me. So I don't know if when you say you're coming for me in an affectionate way or in a kind of like, or in a kind of aggressive way. I don't know the answer. But he, and Andrew pointed out, in my year end concerts list, which was the thing we used to do, I did include the War on Drugs at Pickathon as one of those year-end shows.
That's a surprising statement. Are you trying to see if we're still awake?
What? So here is the question. I, from time to time, get vertigo. Why is that funny?
I just didn't know that we were going to end here with your medical history.
My confessions. These are my confessions.
Go ahead.
From time to time, I get vertigo. I certainly get it when I am under some kind of duress or stress, bodily stress.
I'm sorry.
And I literally can't believe I am bearing my soul on podcast.
Can we point
only
out
to be only to be laughed yes. at? By
I'll just point out that some of this stress comes from deadlines.
No, that's right. Not what this was.
I want to see John land this plane. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. So when I was traveling a lot in the early 2010s and into the mid 2010s, I would, you know, I'd travel and go straight to a concert. I'd fly cross country, not have any water, and then be outside in 100 degree weather. This is what happened at Pickathon. I was not prepared for how intensely hot it would be. I basically spent that entire first day at the festival, no water whatsoever. I remember it being very hard to get water. Like, you had to come in with a bottle, like, you know, some crunchy hippie type thing. And of course, I didn't like bring an empty flask or anything. So I did an entire day, no water. I get back to the hotel that night. I lay down. I like sort of pass out. And about an hour later, I wake up and I actually am suffering from such intense vertigo that I can't get out of bed. Had to go to the emergency room, and I spent the entire next day at the hospital and then spent one more day at the hotel before I flew back.
Did you call an ambulance?
Yes. They came to my room and stretchered me out.
Oh my God.
This is, you know, I think
where
this is before,
the footage?
This is before, this is 2014. So this is before, before you, yeah. This is before you. So yeah, I literally was stretchered out of my Holiday Inn to a local emergency room. And I got, what's the thing where they bill you because the doctor you see is not like covered by your insurance?
American healthcare.
I got surprise billed. I got, after all that, I also got surprise billed for like $800.
Welcome to America.
So that is why I did not do a thorough review of Pickathon. thank you for making me dig up and unearth that traumatic time in my life. Let's go out with the war on drugs, I guess.
Hey.
Karen and Joe, what a true joy to revisit my personal medical history with y'all. And I hope that was a satisfactory answer to everybody who was desperate to know what I thought of Pickathon. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Google, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. And here's some War on Drugs from 2014. This is An Ocean in Between the Waves.
Feel the waves.